think when you've had a training that only tells you that the biology matters or the data matters, this kind of one-dimensional understanding of the world, if you don't even know that those other bodies of knowledge exist, then how are you supposed to reach for them? So we live and learn while wisely guided not to fear what's yet.
Hello, Shavita.
Hi, Jack. How's it going?
All good this side of the Atlantic. Things broadly moving in the right direction, pandemic-wise. A holiday of sorts. Pubs have started opening up. So this episode, I want to start by asking you about vaccines. We talked last time, didn't we, about the excellent piece that you published in Slate, which talked about the case for a precautionary response to warnings of adverse events from the AstraZeneca vaccine. And I guess the thing I just wanted to get your sense of just quickly, now that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which is a similar type of vaccine, appears to have created some of these same rare effects, in Britain at least, you know, there has been no precautionary pausing of the AstraZeneca vaccine. And your piece looks, well, even more prescient. And I just wondered, is that just a relatively easy pattern to understand, or is there something new happening?
It is striking how we're seeing exactly the same response all over again, and exactly the same response to the response. So you have the FDA suspending the use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and you have a concern that this is going to increase vaccine hesitancy. On the one hand, you have people who are saying, oh, it's no problem. You know, we need to do this to demonstrate that the FDA is trustworthy. And on the other hand, people who are saying, oh, my goodness, there's only 6 cases of adverse events, and 6 cases is nothing compared to the 6 million people who've received this vaccine. So therefore, we need to just move forward. This is bad in terms of vaccine hesitancy. One of the things that's interesting is that in Canada, they first said that people under the age of 55 should not take the vaccine. That was in the case of AstraZeneca. And now they've said people under the age of 40 should not take the AstraZeneca vaccine. So they're trying to balance this very complex set of risks, you know, risks of taking the vaccine, which of course is very, very, very low. But in otherwise healthy people, the risk of getting COVID.
One of the things that strikes me as so interesting about this case that maybe is unlike other technology policy cases is that it's not an all or nothing deal, right? Regulators can afford to be a bit harsher with one technological option because other technological options are available, which is really difficult if you're Johnson & Johnson and you're thinking, well, are vaccines being hung out to dry in order to preserve the credibility of Pfizer and Moderna and those other guys? I mean, we've talked a bit about, you know, vaccine competition and vaccine nationalism. And in Britain, the AstraZeneca has a symbolic Union Jack on it. At one point, there was a plan to put an actual Union Jack on it, which was thankfully kiboshed. But yeah, it does mean that these questions are a little bit easier for health technology.
Well, but this is where I think some of my interest in intellectual property comes in, because that is true, but the dynamics of that differ in different countries. So in the US, we have still not approved the AstraZeneca vaccine, which I think is interesting, but we have approved 3 vaccines, Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson. And of those 3, the Johnson & Johnson has been distributed far less than the others because it's really just been ramping up and there have been some supply chain problems. So in the US context, it's not that big of a problem to suspend use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The problem is the dynamics are different in other countries, for example, Canada, where there is much higher use of the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is the one that they're considering suspending. It's also an even bigger problem in a lot of low and middle income countries, where either they were hoping to use the AstraZeneca vaccine because of the way that it's been provided in a non-for-profit way, or the Johnson & Johnson, which is a one-shot deal, which is much easier in rural areas, areas that don't have proper systems that people can actually get access to those vaccines.
Absolutely. So yeah, the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccines look like the tools that might vaccinate the world.
Right.
They're also, right, much, much cheaper to produce. Whether or not the prices of the Pfizer and Moderna ones go down eventually, I mean, it's not that much of an issue for rich healthcare systems where the benefits far outweigh the costs of a single vaccination dose. But if you're talking about the Indian subcontinent, sub-Saharan Africa, the price of a vaccine starts to matter a lot.
The price of a vaccine starts to matter a lot, and simply the issue of supply matters a lot. How much of these different vaccines is actually available? And that's been the emerging problem. I mean, if we right now rely on the current projections and the current way that we've thought about distributing vaccines, especially to low and middle income countries, we're talking about full vaccination or vaccination to get us to herd immunity of something like waiting until 2024. And if you wait until 2024, 3 years from now, we already have seen just in what, 9 months, the development of course, lots of variants, but at least two that are highly transmissible, that are concerning. And people are worried that the virus could mutate beyond the vaccine, and then you would have to start from scratch. And so that's one of the reasons why it's so important to get people vaccinated around the world as fast as possible.
So talk us through then, this is your area. Where are the battle lines currently in the debate about patents, intellectual property for vaccines? If speed is of the essence and if access really, really matters. I know various global bigwigs are taking positions on this. What are the sides and where do you stand on the patent debate?
Yeah, so the status quo right now is that the Western countries, as we've seen, have been vaccinating to varying levels of success, and that the WHO, the World Health Organization, has spearheaded something called the COVAX Initiative. And the COVAX initiative involves donations. The idea is that mostly richer countries provide funding for COVAX, and then the low and middle income countries purchase the vaccines according to their purchasing power. The problem, though, is that there isn't enough vaccine, that some of the vaccines there are problems with, as we've discussed with Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca, that, as you know well, some countries are particularly nationalistic about allowing or not allowing vaccines to leave the country if they're the ones that are making the vaccine. So in the fall, India and South Africa, and it's notable that these two countries were the ones involved, that India and South Africa are countries that actually have manufacturing capacity to create generic versions of these vaccines. So India and South Africa proposed to the World Trade Organization, please waive the patents on the COVID vaccines. Use the authority under the trade-related intellectual property agreement called TRIPS in order to waive the patents on the vaccines. Now, you can assume which countries blocked that. It was the US, the UK, the EU, and Canada.
What were their arguments? Because I'm imagining their arguments weren't, we just want to make as much money as possible, right? They will have had some pragmatic humanitarian type arguments saying, no, actually, what the innovation is quickest when the innovators can benefit financially or something along those lines.
They make a variety of different arguments. The first is that we need a strong patent system in order to inspire innovation, that in any way weakening the patent system will create dangerous precedents that will hurt innovation in the long term. Second of all, they often make the case that this is not going to solve the supply problem. This is where it falls into a sort of racist colonialist argument, right? So the argument is something like, these countries don't know how to manufacture these vaccines. And if we were to allow these countries to manufacture the vaccines, then we wouldn't be able to control the quality of the vaccines. Of course, there's questions around why it is that we make these assumptions about these countries and why, of course, we assume that the standards will be lower in these countries as though they don't have any kind of...
But also, and India are churning out lots of, in a licensed way, the AstraZeneca vaccine.
That's right.
And they might
That's
be doing right. others. Right.
Yeah. There's a robust generics industry in India, as I said, in South Africa, even in Brazil. So it's a matter of transferring manufacturing know-how. But the argument in favor, and you can tell which side I sit on, the argument in favor is, of course, at its base, an equity issue. Westerners are no more deserving of the vaccine than people who live in low and middle income countries. But there are also economic arguments. And I think that now the economic arguments are starting to take some root, which is we have a global economy. If you are essentially saying that a lot of the low and middle income countries where goods and services are produced should not have access to the vaccine, that's going to have economic implications. And then there's the economic slash public health argument, which is that we've seen in recent months how the vaccine mutates. And if we wait until 2024 for the vaccine to reach all of these countries, then we're just testing coronavirus. And coronavirus has proven itself to be a pretty worthy adversary, so I don't want to test the coronavirus.
From a science diplomacy angle, there's one more line, which is that Russia and China have already shown that they're very keen on vaccine diplomacy. There's a sort of enlightened self-interest foreign policy argument that says, actually, the US, the UK should be spreading their vaccines around the world. So where do you think this goes? Because I can see a point at which large proportions of rich country populations get vaccinated, and at that point, their governments say, oh, okay, let's open up the patent pool and we will, in effect, gift this to the world and not set a precedent because these circumstances are so exceptional? I mean, is that likely?
When the discussion of the TRIPS waiver first emerged in the fall, I was strongly supportive of it because of the work that I've done. But I also thought we were tilting at windmills. And in January, I wrote a policy brief to the incoming Biden administration that made some of the arguments that we've been talking about, including the vaccine diplomacy argument, that especially if President Biden is interested in reestablishing connections to the rest of the world, this is a perfect way to do it. But I still felt like it was a bit of tilting at windmills. What is interesting is I'd say over the last month, there has been growing attention and discussion of this issue, even in regular old media sources, places where I've never seen patent conversations before. So that's one thing that's interesting. There have been a few op-eds in the New York Times, et cetera. Perhaps even more interesting has been the number of world leaders that have come out in favor of the waiver. So the World Health Organization head, Dr. Tedros, has now come out and said he's still a fan of COVAX, but he's kind of suggested that it's not enough. You have, I think, 150 former world leaders have signed on to the TRIPS waiver. Just last week, 10 liberal or progressive senators in the U.S. have signed a letter to Biden urging him to support the TRIPS waiver. That's pretty huge. I mean, yes, these are the, you know, this includes Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, but it also includes, you know, Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy and Sherrod Brown of Ohio. So they are on the leftier side, but 10 senators is a significant number, and I've never seen that before. So, and there was also, I think a couple of weeks ago, there was a leak that said that the Biden White House was considering this issue. And in some ways, the more that it gets taken seriously, I think the more the pharma industry is going to pull out the big guns. But I also think that from a public health and economic perspective, certainly, even if you dispense with morals, it's increasingly necessary. So I want to also talk about something else that's been in the news recently, which is your area of expertise, which is I'm in Houston now, actually, visiting my parents in case you hear any background movement. And Houston was the site last week, right, of yet another crash from Tesla car that with some sort of driver assist. So somewhere on the spectrum of the automated vehicle. And I wanted to ask you what your take both on the crash, but also the attention to it and the regulatory actions.
I mean, the first thing to say is, so whenever something like this happens, and there have been dozens of these, right? A Tesla crashes, and in a lot of these cases, crashes at very high speed, and the occupant, or in this case, occupants, two of them, die instantly. And there is this discussion about, well, you know, the novelty of exactly what has transpired. And in this case, the curiosity is that nobody appeared to be in the driving seat of this car. Now, in other Tesla crashes, it has been found that at the time of the crash, autopilot has been switched on. Autopilot is Tesla's driver assist system. That is a not very good piece of technology, but one that Elon Musk and Tesla fanboys, who occasionally shout at me, they think that this is just on the cusp of becoming, with a couple of software updates, a self-driving car in the making. In this instance, Elon Musk has said that autopilot wasn't switched on, and he has access to data that he says tells him, in effect, the status of every Tesla in the US. And for people like me who've been looking at these things for a while, and I wrote a paper a couple of years ago on the first of these deaths, in effect, the first person to have been killed in a car that they thought was a self-driving car, even if technologically it was a long way from that. And since that crash that happened in 2016, there have been, as I say, dozens, and an utter failure to learn from, to really care about, to regulate. And it's been interesting seeing the poverty of the arguments being made from a bunch of people who say, oh, well, thousands of people are dying every month in the US in conventional car crashes. So the tech optimists would say, why pay such attention to one of these cases? And the easy way out is always to blame the user, which is something that we've seen across other automated systems, which is, there's this nice phrase that Madeline Elish has come up with, which is the human becomes the moral crumple zone. It's really easy to just say, oh, well, the user should have known about this system, therefore it's an act of extraordinary stupidity. If it does transpire that there was nobody in the driving seat and they were showing off about what their car could do, that it's very easy to blame the stupid user, even though the users are being told that they're in effect buying a self-driving car. So the hype and the reality of the technology are miles apart in this instance. But it's profoundly depressing. We've had a whole bunch of investigations from an excellent US body called the National Transportation Safety Board, who normally look at aeroplane crashes, that have all said Tesla's system is not very good and Tesla needs to be much more honest about what the limits of their technology are. We've also seen a few more softball interventions from NHTSA, the National Highways Transportation Safety Agency. I think I might have mangled the administration. It's normally administration in the US, right? So, and NHTSA are so keen on the idea of a self-driving car, right? The technological fix to road safety, which is a problem that is getting no better in the US, that they don't want to really upset the apple cart. And I think it's something that the new administration has to act on at some point. How you, if nothing else, regulate the claims that are made for the technology, and then probably regulate the technology itself, because this is an experiment that is being conducted on the American population. It's moral luck that actually in almost all of the cases, the people that have been killed have been the people in the vehicles. At some point, bystanders are going to get run over. Kids are going to get run down, and you might see a very different discussion. Waiting until that point would be a disaster.
So I'm wondering if part of the problem here is that there's no organized opposition or there's no organized critique, and that's often the case when you think about some of these kinds of emerging technologies. It's very difficult to respond to people that are envisioning this beautiful future, to kind of imagine who the constituencies would be that would challenge this. I know that a little bit about this only, but there's a question about whether insurers might try to push for more regulation. But I'm wondering, why is it that the political debate has emerged in such a way that despite the fact that the NTSB has made what sound like fairly clear statements, that industry doesn't feel like they need to comply? There hasn't really been regulatory attention, much less action.
Yeah. So a couple of things there. The first thing to say, so in Europe, there has been a bit more regulatory attention, right? And in particular, the German regulators have said, Tesla have got to stop using the word autopilot because it's nothing of the sort. And they need to be a lot stricter on the circumstances in which they allow users to turn on this technology. It has to be very, very predictable in effect. Freeways, autobahns, motorways, those sorts of roads. And in the US, there has been some organized opposition from consumer groups on the grounds that, in effect, people are being lied to when they buy this stuff, which is pragmatically, it's the easiest argument that you can level against Tesla, which is that at the moment, people are being asked to pay thousands extra for a technology that isn't what it claims to be. So they're being fleeced. However, it's interesting to think about where the fanboy opposition to those arguments manifests. So the easy response to the German regulators is, oh, well, you would say that, wouldn't you? Because you're trying to protect companies like Volkswagen and Audi and BMW that are laggards, and they don't want to be disrupted by a self-driving future. So there is that argument that says that regulation is inherently conservative and just protecting the incumbents. There's also, you know, this powerful argument that acts as a form of moral blackmail, which is that in the US, 40,000 people die every year, about the same sort of number as die in gun deaths from gun death in automobile accidents, right? And that is a disaster. And action on that regard has been woeful in the US, and the US is worse than other places. And therefore, average improvements in just in public health terms, right? There is a public health case to be made. Now, it so happens that at the moment, it's quite hard to make that case because the technology does not exist. But that if you get carried away with the hype, that's the way the argument runs. The other thing is, particularly with Tesla, if you argue against Tesla, you're accused of being one of two things. One is being in the pocket of big oil because you're trying to protect gasoline cars. The other one is that you are a Tesla short, right? That you're shorting Tesla shares. And it's a really interesting way that these arguments always run on Twitter, which is that either you're an investor in Tesla or you're an investor against Tesla. The idea that you have no financial interest in Tesla is a rather hard thing for them to comprehend. The other place where you might see some form of organized opposition to these claims is from other self-driving car makers who see Tesla as a gigantic reputational risk. And I know this because I spend a lot of time talking to them. They won't say it publicly because they don't want to hang out their competitors in that way. And they'll be accused of sour grapes and, you know, they'll be accused of being losers and all the rest of it. But, you know, they are really, really worried that another few crashes, some bystander deaths could damage the whole enterprise and take down what they would regard as the good actors along with the bad.
Are you referring to what you might call legacy car manufacturers? I mean, are we talking about the big three that I know in the US, for example, they are getting in this game? But I guess it's a bigger question about whether the older companies that have been around for a long time, who have weathered all of these wars around regulation, might approach regulation slightly differently than, for example, Tesla.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're Tesla, you would say, well, you can't trust the big three because they've all had regulators in their pocket since the 1930s. There is a bit of that. But also there's companies like Waymo, for example, who have expanded their operations massively, who fit into a very different regulatory conversation. You see them and a few of the other Silicon Valley companies organizing, lobbying. They have their own lobby groups. And it is notable that Tesla is not a part of one of the biggest self-driving car lobby groups. And so you see they don't want to make an example out of Tesla, but they're terrified that Tesla's irresponsibility is going to be their undoing as well. Now we should talk about who we've got coming up on the episode.
Yes. So we are talking to Angela Saini, who is a science journalist. She's written 3 books. She wrote a book called Inferior about gender and science, Geek Nation about Indian science and globalization. But the book that we spoke to her about, even though it was published about a year ago, is still quite timely, is called Superior, The Return of Race Science. And what I really appreciate about that book, it's a really wonderful book, is that it really takes you into race science, and it does so in a general interest way. So she's obviously also talked to lots of historians and anthropologists of science and STS scholars and brings those perspectives into the discussion, but she also engages in her own exploration and does so in a way that really brings the questions about why we are so obsessed with having a race science in the first place really to light and makes them come alive. And I really enjoyed the interview.
Yeah, it was really interesting. And also there's an interesting sort of COVID angle on it as well, because of, you know, the differential impact of COVID that was detected relatively early on in the pandemic. So we hope you enjoy it.
So dive right in.
So Angela, thank you so much for joining us. We originally met when you came to our department here in UCL. You had published a brilliant book, Inferior, looking at gender in science and the science of gender. And then you, when you came to UCL, you were talking about what was going to be your new book, Superior, which was all about science and race, the science of race, race in science. It had an extraordinary impact. It genuinely has informed and changed the debate on science, the history of science, and how we think about race. And it's had impact well beyond just the community of science thinkers and science writers. So I guess the first thing to ask you is about the sort of motivation for putting together that Superior book.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. I appreciate it. I didn't think of Inferior and Superior as related books. The titles suggest otherwise, but that's because the publishers come up with a title rather than me. Yeah. But I really thought of them as separate things in my head. And that's partly because race really is a social construct. There is nothing biological about it at all. It may overlap with some biological variables, but it is a pseudoscience, really, race science. Whereas the study of sex differences and gender is more deeply rooted in the sciences, in biology, the social sciences. And of course, there's a huge amount of work that goes on there. So they were different books in some way. And Superior, I think, is a lot more, there's a lot more politics and history in there, because I don't think it can be treated as a biological question, because it's not a biological entity we're talking about. It is a historic and social question, really.
Why does the science of race refuse to die in that case?
Well, there are lots of reasons. One is that when modern Western science first emerged, there were certain social assumptions that were made about humans. And one of those was that the human species could be divided up into groups. And once that assumption was made, then huge efforts were made to do just that. We can understand now, looking back, that that was because there are no natural subdivisions between us. There is no straight line that divides any group of people. So any division that is made, any categorization that's done, has to depend on the perspective of the observer. And it has to be arbitrary by its nature. It can't be anything else because, like I said, there are no natural subdivisions. And having developed this system then, and certain categories becoming more popular than others. So the one that we use now is this very broad color-based category. And just think, we could have divided people any way we liked, but we went with this color. And these very broad categories of black, white, yellow, brown, red, which were developed around the time of the Enlightenment, are what we still use now. And they were given meaning. So they had meaning at the beginning in the minds of the people who developed them, because they correlated with certain social and political ideas they had about the world. And then in turn, they were given that same meaning by scientists when they started exploring human difference and what it meant. So you get in the 19th century, people doing quite random and crazy experiments to establish whether black people, for instance, suffer pain differently from white people, or whether their bones are denser or their skin is thicker, all based on that assumption. So it really came to form the bedrock of the science of human difference. As time went on, of course, that started to unravel because the basis upon which they did that was spurious in the first place.
So I'm just curious, you use the word pseudoscience, which I think might catch some of our listeners off guard. And I guess I had a couple of questions about that. The first is, when you approached the project, did you approach it with an understanding that it was pseudoscientific, and sort of what made it interesting to you, this topic? And then at what stage, what kind of convinced you that this is, was there a particular example that clearly blew up the idea of the biological basis of race for you?
I actually didn't approach it assuming that it was pseudoscientific. And in fact, I don't use that word very much in the book. When I talk about race science, I call it race science because it's only with hindsight that we understand how pseudoscientific it was. At the time, it was just science. It was part of mainstream thinking. Like I said, this was the basis upon which people carried out their investigations into human difference. And to be honest, in the modern day, there are still many people, scientists among them, who still aren't completely convinced that there isn't some validity to using race in biology or invoking it, for example, in medical research. And I perhaps also suspected that there was some validity. And the reason for that, of course, is that when we go to our doctor and they tell us that being Asian or being black has an impact on your health outcomes or what kind of drug you should be prescribed in some cases, then it's very difficult not to assume something like that. So there are these kind of widespread folk beliefs that we have around science and race, biology and race, that I think deep down before I started writing Superior, I had also internalized. And the book really was a challenge to all of that. It was an affront to my understanding, and I think also for readers.
As you know, I mean, UCL has an ignominious history of eugenics that the institution has been trying to uncover and work its way through the last couple of years. And I guess the sort of easy, convenient story to tell about race science is that it was the construction, A, it's something historical, and B, it was the construction of scientists who were also racist.
Yeah.
Or to look in contemporary terms at, you know, white supremacists who now invoke particular science for their own ends. Is there a danger that that sort of lets the rest of science off the hook?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the points that I try very hard to make, is that if we consign this to history, if we treat it, if we use the word pseudoscience about it, then we absolve ourselves of still being tainted by these ideas, of still perpetuating these ideas in modern day scientific thinking. And that is very problematic. It's very easy to look into the past and call people racist, because racism in the 19th century wasn't thought of as a bad thing. That was just how people thought about human difference. It was quite accepted among scientists that there was a kind of evolutionary hierarchy between races. Not only that races existed, which was a given at that time, but that there was a kind of hierarchy between them, that some were more evolved than others. So to use that word racist in that context, then only in the 21st century can we see the moral implications of it. At the time, that was impossible to know. The time itself was racist. And I would argue that even now we live in racist societies. Yeah. And when we see these ideas being used in new ways, sometimes, but sometimes even in the old ways, but often repackaged by modern day researchers, we imagine that that has nothing to do with what happened in the 19th century. I would argue it has everything to do with what happened then.
One question I had, sort of following up on this, is you talk about this a little bit in the book, but I'm hoping you might tell us even more. That is, how scientists of race, scientists who are doing this sort of work, see themselves, how do they respond to the idea that there's something deeply problematic about the work that they're doing? And how might we start to manage whether and how we should engage in these kinds of scientific investigations in the first place?
You know, it's interesting when, so I'm not the first person to write on this topic. Of course, lots of people have written on it, and many geneticists have written on the science of race over many decades. So there's a long literature there. When Superior came out, I wasn't just looking at the past. I was making some accusations of people living now about the way that they were thinking about these ideas in inappropriate ways. Around the time that the book came out last summer, there was a feature that I wrote for New Scientist magazine on population genetics, because I think this is one of those fields that has not completely abandoned the baggage of the past. And I have a couple of chapters on that. And I was messaged on social media by a couple of population geneticists at Cambridge who took huge exception to what I had written, because they basically said to me, "We are not the racists here. The racists are those people over there, the white supremacists, the kind of race realists, the alt-righters, who we're arguing with on the internet every day. We are not the problem." And of course, you know, going back to what we just discussed, the problem there is that when the racist is the other person, then you ignore whatever biases and assumptions you have in yourself that are causing problems. Now, what happened after that summer was one of those population geneticists, Ewan Burney, he read my book. We had a really constructive dialogue at the end of it. This summer, or this autumn, I should say, I was invited to speak at one of the institutions that he works at, the Wellcome Genome Campus in Cambridge. And Ewan introduced me, he interviewed me, and his view was completely different. He completely championed my work. And in the same way that I have, he has also gone through the process of asking, well, actually, should our language and frameworks change as a result? And for me, that is progress. I've seen Superior this autumn, and I don't think it's because of the strength of the book. I think it's actually because the politics of this has all changed. After George Floyd, all institutions, I work with many museums and other scientific institutions on these topics, and their position on these things have changed. They're willing to look at themselves and interrogate themselves in different ways. And the tone has completely changed. Superior is now on reading lists at Harvard and Oxford. And I don't think that would have happened last year, not because the book was any different last year, but because the political climate has changed.
I mean, I think one thing that you talk about in the book, but perhaps framed in the light of 2020 looks quite different, is you talk about how the scientists who are engaged in this research often say, well, that's politics, and what I'm doing is science, I'm being driven by the data. And of course, that distinction is something that we've talked about a lot on the podcast, that is the sort of idea that science somehow exists outside of politics. And I wonder if part of what has happened over the last year is an understanding that science and politics are inextricably intertwined, and you can't do this kind of work without grappling with the political meaning of, for example, as you were saying, the categories and the frameworks.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a very difficult thing, I think, for scientists to accept, not least because of the way that we are trained. I studied engineering at university. I got next to no training or understanding of the origins of ideas, how knowledge is constructed. That all for me came much later when I was working. I did a degree part-time at King's College London in their Science and Security Department, which is part of their war studies group. And that was where I was introduced to, for example, feminist critiques of science and technology. And when you start doing that, then you start to see how fragile actually many of these orthodoxies within science are, how much debate and conversation were had around ideas even at the time, and why we're still having them, that mistakes can be made very easily, and only by challenging them with politics sometimes do we get progress. That experience completely changed the way that I thought about science and informed both Inferior and Superior. What I would love to see is more scientists get that kind of training at the undergraduate level. Because when they don't, that's where you get these strange situations where very prominent scientists sometimes Nobel Prize winners, make quite ridiculous statements that seem so wildly sexist and racist. They still do that. And that's because they don't know their history.
There's a lot within cultures of science and systems of education of science that leads practicing scientists towards a sort of defensive attitude that you describe. Ewan Burney is maybe a particularly interesting person in that regard to be able to say, oh, yes, the presumptions that I had about science, that it was disinterested and colorblind or post-racial or whatever form of neutrality you like. You know, it takes a lot to undermine those assumptions. And it's not necessarily saying, oh, the activity that you're engaged in is dirty or sordid or one political way or the other, but it's in some way ill-prepared for engaging with these discussions.
Yeah, and in fact, if you think about it, it's the more scientific approach to take to these issues. I mean, if science is about interrogating our assumptions, our biases, asking what other things can explain what I'm seeing, and here I'm talking particularly about inequality, there are so many ways to explain the inequality that we see out in the world. One of them is to say, as people did in the 19th century and still some people still do now, that it's just natural, that there are fundamental differences between groups. And that is why, for example, Western nations have succeeded and other nations haven't. That's why women are underrepresented in certain professions and men do this and women do that. That's one way of explaining it. But there are so many other ways of explaining what we see through looking at society and politics and the long history of exclusion, discrimination, and oppression. And I think when you've had a training that only tells you that the biology matters or the data matters, this kind of one-dimensional understanding of the world, if you don't even know that those other bodies of knowledge exist, then how are you supposed to reach for them? And I think that's a fundamental limitation in modern day scientific teaching in this country. In the US, at least, there is this kind of liberal arts training that draws you out of that to some extent, but it's siloing, basically.
Can I ask you a more controversial question than the question of scientific education? Is the question of whether there are particular bits of science that are just so prone to this form of pollution, I guess, that in effect there should be no-go areas for scientific research, and in particular research on the relationship between genetics and intelligence. Is there an easy answer to that question?
I personally take the view that if you can get your work funded by a reputable funder, published in a reputable journal, and peer-reviewed reliably and honestly, then you should be able to do whatever work you want. The reason that this kind of work, so for example, studies into racial differences in intelligence, for instance, isn't done, is the same reason that there aren't scientists looking at the possibility that the Earth is flat. It's just because we know so, and we've known for decades so clearly that we are one human species. We can't be divided into races. So then how can you possibly do? It's just...
Right, so it's just bad science.
Well, I wouldn't say... See, the phrase bad science, what that does is it has a value judgment to it, which is a moral one, as well as the scientific one. And this isn't just a moral question. This is about which questions still have validity. Now, that said, that doesn't mean that scientists don't invoke race in their research. And sometimes they do it in ways that they don't always appreciate or inappropriate. And I think this happens particularly in medical research all the time.
One of the phenomena that I've noticed over the last year or two, but I remember this case that you talk about in the book, the Kanazawa case, where he talks about the attractiveness of Black women, and then he basically was shamed on the internet and the post went down. One of the things that we've seen over the last year or two on social media has been in predominantly, I've seen it when it comes to artificial intelligence publications, but these were cases somewhat unlike Kanazawa's in that these seem to be funded research projects that were then published in reputable journals, but they were based on racist presuppositions. There was misinterpretations of history. While often they would claim some kind of interdisciplinary knowledge, they really didn't have any. There was a recent one about, I think, using a bunch of European pictures, I think from the 17th century, to judge trustworthiness. And then they decided that we basically trusted people with white faces. So, you know, no kidding. But I'm wondering what you think about the sort of role that social media now plays in policing acceptable research. Because I think there are both benefits and risks to it.
There are risks to it, there's no doubt. And especially with cancel culture, we get sometimes disproportionate responses to certain things and sometimes no responses to other things. You know, it really depends on what takes people's attention on that particular day. I think, though, on the plus side, what the internet, and not just social media, so I think more broadly on the internet, what's happening is that people are in some cases filling the gap that should be filled by the scientific establishment itself. We know if you go to the website Retraction Watch, you can see how many papers get retracted with racist or sexist subtext to them, or sometimes overtly kind of pushing racist or sexist ideas. And you have to ask yourself, how is that possible? How is this stuff getting through what is meant to be a very thorough and rigorous process? This publication process is supposed to prevent that kind of thing. It's still getting through. For me as a journalist, I have to ask myself, what position am I going to take on this? Am I going to be generous and say, well, this kind of stuff gets through because not all journals have enough resources and maybe peer reviewers are sometimes a bit lazy and they let things get through? I am less inclined to be that generous these days because there are certain journals which are published by some of the very major journal groups, including Elsevier, Taylor and Francis, Sage, in which this happens all the time. And then you have to ask, well, how is that happening? If you look at the editorial board, there are people who have contributed to the Mankind Quarterly, which is this scientific racist journal published after the Second World War. There are contributors and editors of the Mankind Quarterly on the board of Intelligence, and then this stuff gets published. And then you have to say, well, you know, it's very difficult to be generous in that case. Then there are deliberate forces at work here that want this published, that don't care about its quality, the scientific quality of these papers, that they don't care about the moral or ethical repercussions of it, because they share that worldview. And that for me is terrifying, because what it says is that within academia, and actually we should know this already, because there are academics around the world who are white supremacists, who hold very strong views that could be called scientifically racist or scientifically sexist or both, there are elements within the establishment who are still pushing away at this. And what social media is doing in those cases then is holding a light up to them that the establishment itself is not able to do.
Right, because things like journals and peer review, we recognise that they are an extremely poor form of accountability. They're a sort of internalist way for science to maintain some form of quality control, but they go very little distance in satisfying the desire for social accountability for science more broadly.
Yeah, but the thing is, a lot of journals have not come under as much scrutiny as they are coming under now because the internet didn't exist before. Now it's easy. Any layperson can go online and read papers, especially in this open access world. And that means they can't get away with it so easily. But more fundamentally, the problem that this causes is that papers are not just being read by other academics. And in turn, what that means is that when the public can read them and when that accountability does happen, for example, on websites like Retraction Watch, which catalogues when papers are retracted and shows why they're retracted and how, and the problems that lie beneath, is that the public then loses faith in science. So last summer, I founded an organization that now sits under the Royal Institution of Great Britain called Challenging Pseudoscience. So we're now a formal organization, but we were informal then. And we look at issues like this. How is it that this kind of thing happens, and what does it do to public trust in science? And for me, it's as damaging, for example, as anti-vaccine sentiment. What we saw with that Andrew Wakefield paper a number of years ago was that it may have been retracted, but because we have the internet now, it has this long life online. People still use it and cite it and use it as a means to forward their particular views on vaccination. And if the establishment can't get its house in order, then mistrust in science of that kind will just continue. And it will be completely valid that it will continue, because how can you trust an establishment that allows these mistakes to happen?
Can I ask you, Angela, about a thing that I know that you've been thinking about, the sort of lazy idea that a pandemic, we're all in this together, it's a great leveler, is challenged by knowledge that emerged quite early on that actually the pandemic was affecting some racial groups more than others. And I just really want to get your thoughts on how problematic that is, because in a way it's sort of drawing attention to important inequalities, but also it may be reifying some of those distinctions and maybe scientizing them in ways that you find problematic. Can you say a bit about that?
Well, I had a very strange pandemic because in February and March, I went to Norway, and when I came home, I was very sick. So I don't know if I had COVID-19. I had almost all of the symptoms, but there was no testing then unless you were in hospital. So I can't know. And I avoided anything COVID-related in the news because it just panicked me and made me feel worse. When I did, by around April time, start looking at what was being written, and it was around March or April that we started to see these big gaps that you're talking about. So these huge ethnic disparities in COVID outcome and death, particularly in London, where the virus hit first. And what shocked me was that there were prominent physicians, medical researchers, some of the top universities in the country, who were speculating as to whether this might have some genetic basis, that there was some gene that non-white people shared that made us more susceptible to this virus without any basis. They had no evidence for that, and yet there was this speculation happening. And what surprised me was that we have always seen racial disparities in health. We've always had racial disparities in health. For example, in the US, Black Americans have shorter life expectancies than white Americans. They die of almost everything at greater rates than white Americans, including infant mortality. In this country, Black women are 5 times more likely to die in childbirth and while pregnant than white women. And other minorities also face similar disproportionate rates of poor outcome. So why didn't they expect that to play out in the event of a pandemic? Why did we imagine that whatever causes those structural issues around health disparities all the rest of the time wouldn't play out in 2020 when we have a pandemic? You know, I became so incensed about this, and I spoke to a few of my friends. We were tracking. I have one friend in particular, Pete Roble, who used to be a sub-editor at Nature and New Scientist. And together over the phone, we were tracking the data from Public Health England. And what we saw was that, yes, there were big ethnic disparities at the beginning. They started slowly to level out towards June and July as the virus moved out of London. London, which is a minority white British city, in which the demographics would quite heavily predict that ethnic minorities would be disproportionately affected. As the virus started to move out, some of the worst hit areas by June were the Northeast. So some of the whitest places in the country were being hardest hit. And one of the reasons for that, again, is because of poverty. This is, of course, because socioeconomic status is heavily correlated to health outcomes, so much so in this country that poorer people have lower life expectancies than richer people. We know that. And in fact, that gap has been getting wider over the last 10 years. Race overlaps with that.
But also it's been really hard for people to talk about that gap, and for a conservative government to say the impacts of it are hugely uneven on socioeconomic terms is actually harder for them to say than there appear to be some uneven racial impacts on it. It's sort of a peculiar bind.
Well, that's because you can biologize race and you can't biologize class. Or you know, yeah. There have been attempts, but we don't biologize class in the same way that we biologize race. So if you say that there are ethnic minority disparities in health, then people can think to themselves, oh, well, that's because the biology is different here. You can't say that about poor people and rich people. And so it's a much more palatable thing, claim to be making. But in fact, the biggest discrepancies that we see, if we really are talking about disparities, are, of course, between old people and young people. It's not between particular groups. There are issues here. There are systemic issues that cause those disparities that we see. But the biggest difference is between old and young, which again suggests that genetics can't be particularly salient here because your genetics don't change between you being 5 and 75.
Yeah. Shabita, how did this play out in the US?
As you were talking, I was thinking it's a very similar story. You know, we apparently had a pandemic playbook, but of course that pandemic playbook doesn't talk about any sorts of inequalities, in fact, which is itself very shocking, but in terms of the history of the pandemic itself, it tracks exactly as you guys are talking about, which is that first people talked about how, oh, it's the great leveler. Then immediately people started to talk about how it disproportionately affects people of color. Now it has moved into rural areas and it's spreading very rapidly. So the additional challenge that we have in the US is that in addition to the socioeconomic disparities, we also have hospital systems that are privatized and response to the marketplace. In areas with lower socioeconomic status, we have fewer hospitals, hospitals with less resources. And so that's going to exacerbate the problems, certainly in terms of capacity. But for me, one of the things that it's challenging to talk about, and I'm curious, Angela, how you think about this. On the one hand, I think there is a lot of importance put on the disproportionate impacts on people of color, because these are communities that have experienced deep disparities, as you said, over long periods of time. We're also at a moment where these are communities that are starting to have some political agency and power. People are starting to pay attention. And so they're actually able to speak and be heard. But there is a risk there, as you were saying, that the biological differences will get essentialized. And we even, to some degree, even see this with regards to gender a little bit, I think, as well. And so I'm wondering what you think about this and how we think about this going forward in terms of identity politics and essentialism post-COVID-19.
Well, I think one of the things I've argued a lot for this year is to understand that science isn't just about facts, about having correct facts. And this is something that's been informed by the work I've done on misinformation and pseudoscience with this group at the RI. It's not just about having facts. It's about how those facts are spun into narratives and what those narratives then say, because you can build very different stories around the same facts. I think one of the casualties of identity politics, and I have to say I'm in favor of identity politics, I think we need it in order to fight for rights, to understand who is suffering disproportionately. We can't do it otherwise. But one of the problems is that we become so entrenched within these identities, we reify these identities so much that we can't help but slip into biologized ways of thinking about them. And we see that happening in terms of race, even by well-meaning, anti-racist, non-white scientists as well. So you see people who are so keen to address the problem, for example, of poorer health within their communities, that they will start as researchers looking at the possibility that there are genetic differences inside them that make them more susceptible, rather than looking at the other narrative, which says, well, actually, genetics is perhaps the last place I should be looking. The first place I should be looking are the social determinants of health. This was actually, ironically, an issue that was raised by the British Medical Journal just in February. They put out a special issue on race in medicine. And within that issue, they put out a call for research that looked at these kind of social determinants of health, the ways in which racism and discrimination affect health. And they had to admit in that issue that they didn't get what they needed. The research just wasn't out there. And that's really problematic, because if we're talking about racial disparities in health, this is where we should be looking first. We should be looking at things like socioeconomic status, how it varies in very subtle ways within communities, within households sometimes. We should be looking at diet, demographics, patterns of work, all these different things. In that sense, the US is a little bit more ahead. There is at least research being done there. One of the champions, in fact, is Mary Bassett, New York City Health Commissioner, who's really been plugging away at this for many, many years, trying to shift that narrative, shift that focus onto social determinants. When it comes to gender, again, I think in this world of identity politics, what we see happening is that we know that women are disadvantaged in some ways when it comes to certain health outcomes or in lots of different ways. It's very easy, again, to biologize that, to say, for instance, we can see, and I've seen people do this, I've seen activists do this, look at the fact that Black women suffer such high rates of mortality and say it's because we don't have enough research on women and on Black women in particular. We don't have enough research looking at their bodies and how their bodies are different, how women's bodies are different from men's bodies. And that's a very dangerous road to go down, because what it implies is that our bodies are so profoundly different that a black woman will be five times more likely to die in childbirth than a white woman. It's well-intentioned, it comes from a good place, but it's using exactly the wrong narratives to explain the set of facts that we see. There's been this spate of books that have come out in the last couple of years arguing that women's bodies are completely different from men's bodies, that, you know, we need different drugs, that drugs tested on men won't work in women, which is just nonsense. It really is such a dangerous way of thinking about human difference, because even though there are some harder differences, for example, gynecological, everything else sits on a spectrum. Everything else overlaps quite heavily. Even hormone levels, which we saw, for example, in the case of Caster Semenya, this is what causes us such problems, is that when we don't recognize the overlap and the complexity here around sex, then we really struggle when we're forcing ourselves to think in these binary ways about the differences that we see. What we need to understand is that a lot of what we're seeing, some of it may be down to sex, a lot of it is down to gender. And here I can highly recommend the brilliant work of Sarah Richardson at Harvard, who I think is a massively underquoted researcher in this field. She has, again, very heavily pushed for us to shift this narrative, to understand that sex is more complex than we imagine it to be.
Is there anything else, Angela, that we need to cover?
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, this year, when we're talking about race and COVID-19, there was a big, I noticed it was palpable, a big change in the way that scientists were talking about it that happened over the summer. I am convinced that the reason for that change in narrative was not because of science change, but because of the George Floyd murder. So I remember early on in the summer, before that murder happened, I was writing an essay for The Lancet on racial disparities in COVID outcomes and health. And The Lancet was so resistant to what I was writing that their essays, which are usually not peer-reviewed at all, they got two layers of peer review. And, you know, they were just so reluctant to accept even this basic statement that race was a social construct. They wanted me to qualify that again and again and again. And then the George Floyd murder happened and everything changed. Everything. Suddenly, people were quoting this essay that I'd written. More people were asking me to write about this topic. And The Lancet invited me to be part of their COVID-19 commission. So you can just see, you know, sometimes it's not the science that changes the minds of scientists. It is actually the politics. We gather our hands and hope for the best, but only a fool would let the world just spin. The Received Wisdom podcast is edited by Edward Weissonen and produced with help from the Shapiro Design Lab at the University of Michigan. We would love it if you would subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting platforms. You can also find all the recordings, transcripts, and links to the books, articles, and other stuff we discuss in this episode at our website, thereceivedwisdom.org. That's thereceivedwisdom, one word, .org. Talk to you soon.